some notes. So my name is Rob Speckens. I'm going to be telling you about foundations of quantum theory. So I thought I would start by telling you a bit about what the field concerns, what the major activities in the field are. So the first thing is that there's a widespread sense in the community of people who study foundations of quantum mechanics that we're still lacking an adequate interpretation. So one of the things that people study is the formalism and how to interpret it. And there are debates about what the appropriate interpretation is. Secondly, people look at non-classical phenomena. So people are trying to find phenomena which somehow resist explanation by classical means. So examples of that would be Bell's theorem or a quantum eraser experiment or double slit, a long list of examples that people have come up with of phenomena that seem surprisingly quantum or uniquely quantum in some way. And then third of all, there's an attempt to axiomatize quantum mechanics, to provide better postulates for deriving the mathematical formalism. And so the idea here is that one wants to do something similar to what you have in special relativity, where you have a couple of physical principles from which the mathematical formalism is derived, rather than something that's purely mathematical to begin with. So that's roughly speaking the areas that people work in. They're not independent. So for example, if you look at non-classical phenomena, you find something interesting. That might give you ideas for what kinds of principles might underlie the formalism. And so you might start an axiomatic scheme based on some phenomena that you've discovered. And furthermore, I think a really important connection is between axiomatization and interpretation. So my view is that the best sorts of interpretations are ones that are motivated by a simple axiomatization of quantum theory. So this course is going to be actually focused on the first one. It's going to be focused on interpretations. But we'll touch at various points upon these other aspects as well. And so I should say that for a few years now, I've been trying to write a textbook on interpretations of quantum theory with my former PhD supervisor, John Seitt. And so we have, it's still in draft form, and we have drafts of many chapters, and it's quite long. So I'm going to be providing you with drafts of some of those chapters at various points. And I want to emphasize that you don't feel like you have to read everything. The book is too long for a course of this length. But I will give you various chapters, and the idea is that if you are particularly interested in something or unclear about something, then you can go to the draft of the book and maybe get some clarification on it. And I'll be handing out a few other things that supplement the material that we have in draft form, because the outline of this course is not quite the same as the outline of the book. And so I should also say that a lot of the material for this course is developed in collaboration with John Seitt. So he's to thank for some of what's good, if there's anything that's good here. OK, so let's get started. First question I want to talk about today is, what's the problem with quantum theory? So I mentioned that some people think that there's an interpretational problem. But what is the problem, really? Is there one? So I want to start with what you might call the orthodox postulates of quantum theory. So this is the sort of thing that you might find in a standard textbook on quantum theory. Textbooks will differ on exactly the phrasing of the postulates, but roughly speaking, this is what you'll find. So typically, the first postulate has to do with the states of a system. And it says that the rays of a Hilbert space, so this is the vectors modulo their phases, correspond one-to-one with the physical states of the system. And so you can think of this as the representational completeness of psi. It claims that there's nothing else to say about the system except for its quantum state. The second postulate concerns measurement. It says that if a Hermitian operator A with spectral projectors PK is measured, so measurements are associated with this Hermitian operators, if you do this particular measurement, then the probability of getting outcome k is just the expectation value for the associated projector. And furthermore, these probabilities are objective. So it's not just that you have some uncertainty of something. There's no matter of fact in the world that determines which of these outcomes are going to occur. and therefore the theory is fundamentally indeterministic. The third postulate concerns the evolution of isolated systems, and it says that that evolution is unitary. So the physical states of the system, which are represented by these quantum states, evolve according to some unitary operator, which is just an exponentiation of a Hamiltonian. I can continuously deform this to identity. So that tells me that the evolution is continuous. And furthermore, if you specify psi at one time, then you can determine psi at all later times and all earlier times. Therefore, it's deterministic. And then finally, there's a postulate concerning how systems evolve during the course of a measurement. So if the Hermitian operator A with spectral projectors PK is measured and outcome K is obtained, then the physical state of the system changes discontinuously according to the projection postulate, which is says that psi goes to the projection of psi into the eigenspace associated with eigenvalue K and then normalized so that it has a norm 1 again. So this should be familiar. I hope this is familiar. And the question is, is there a problem here? So let me put it to you. Does anybody see a problem with these postulates? Yes?
Seems rather ad hoc that we make a distinction between the third and fourth postulate. I mean, that we have that some evolution is continuous and then some evolution is discontinuous. Why does that compel?
Great. Anything else?
Obviously, numping it is a really good framework for interpreting what we mean by an absolute or objective probability.
Yep, it could be an issue with probabilities. Other problems? Anyone uncomfortable about something else?
Continuous changes of physical states.
Continuous changes.
Discontinuous.
Oh, discontinuous. Yeah, that seems odd from the perspective of the rest of physics. Yes, go ahead.
Define undergoing measurement.
Good, yes. Measurement is certainly undefined here. These are all good points. And a question one can have is whether these are criticisms that can be met somehow, that one is uncomfortable with discontinuous changes, but there's no problem that, you just have to get used to these new things. Or maybe there's really a problem here, there's some sort of inconsistency. So I'll get to that. Let me start, though, with the last point about measurement. So something that people often point out is that the term measurement appears in these postulates, and it's not defined in terms of more primitive terms like physical states of systems. And yet, if you think that measurement devices are just collections of atoms like anything else, and they're interacting with systems, then you might think that the theory ought to specify how atoms behave, and some effective consequence of that will be how measurement devices behave. And I don't need a special postulate to tell me how measurement devices behave. It'll just be a consequence of how its components behave. So you can take a strategy for improving these postulates, which is the first one I've indicated here, which I'll call the realist strategy. So the realist strategy says, the fundamental or the primitive concepts in terms of which a theory should be described are things like systems and their properties and so forth. And therefore, we should eliminate the term measurement from the postulates. We should eliminate it as a primitive concept and describe everything in terms of physical states. Those are the only concepts to which we should appeal in the postulates. So that's one strategy, and I'll talk a bit more about that in a few minutes. Let me talk first, though, about the second strategy. So there's certain people who say, no, that's the wrong move. Actually, science is just about making predictions, really. And all this talk about physical states of systems is really the inappropriate stuff that's found in those postulates. And we should eliminate that. So don't talk about the physical states of a system. And instead, describe everything in terms of operational concepts. So things like measurements and stuff you do in the lab. But be consistent about it. Describe it only in terms of the things that are done in the lab. So let me start with that second case. Oh, first, I should say that it's not as if one of these things is, clearly ridiculous, and the other one is what everybody believes. There are very famous and noteworthy scholars of quantum theory who take each side. So, for example, John Bell is quoted as having said things that would support a realist strategy. It would seem that the theory is exclusively concerned about results of measurement and has nothing to say about anything else. But what exactly qualifies some physical system to play the role of measurer? And he made a call for eliminating this term measurement from quantum theory altogether. On the other hand, if you look at Asher Perez's very nice textbook on quantum theory, which I noticed is outside on the bookshelf, he takes a very operational approach. And he says, in a strict sense, quantum theory is a set of rules allowing the computational probabilities for the outcomes of tests which follow specified preparations. And that's it, according to him. OK, so let's get into this operational strategy a bit more deeply. I should say, by way of preparatory comment, that this is these two strategies are really, they stem from different philosophies of science. So in this book I'm writing, there's an entire chapter, sort of background on different philosophies of science and the history of ideas about what science is. And the operational approach stems from an empiricist tradition. So it goes back to people like Hume and Mach, who said that the role of science is not to explain, but to describe our observations. And everything should be described in terms of observable quantities. And ultimately, this led to logical positivism. And more recently, Percy Bridgman, who is an American physicist, made the claim that we should recast all of our terms in terms of operational concepts. So if you have a concept like an electron, Bridgman claims, well, that any statement about electron is really shorthand a statement about a bunch of things that you would observe in the lab. And he took that to be the lesson of special relativity, that you know, every concept is really a long specification of what you ought to do. So that's the background. And there are people today who think that this is really the right approach. So let's consider a standard quantum experiment from an operational point of view. So this is the Stern-Gerlach experiment, or a schematic of it. So over here, we have an oven that has it generates silver atoms. So we have an aperture at the front. Open the aperture. Silver atoms come out. We collimate the beam so that the wave packet will move forward in a well-defined way. And then we pass that beam through an inhomogeneous magnetic field. And I apologize, these field lines should be pointing in the opposite direction. And the effect of that inhomogeneous magnetic field is to deflect the atom in a way that depends on its magnetic moment. And so quantization of angular momentum tells us that it'll only be deflected one of two angles because it's a spin one-half system. And so you'll find it either spin up or spin down along the axis of the inhomogeneous magnetic field. So I just described that experiment using this sort of mix of talk about a system and its properties, like its magnetic moment, and the measurements we're doing on it. At the very end, we have a screen that's going to detect whether it's up or down. But an operationalist would say, well, that description, strictly speaking, is inappropriate. You shouldn't be talking about what's going on between the oven and these devices, and this idea that there's a particle there will get you into trouble. What you really should just be saying is, here's what I did in the laboratory. So it's you specify a long list of instructions. You know, I heated up this chunk of silver, and I had the apertures aligned this way, and I did all this stuff, and I pressed go, you know, I pressed start, right, and the experiment proceeded. And then ultimately, I observed something. So I set up a bunch of things over here on the measurement side, and then I observed something. And so the idea is that you want to encapsulate all of this just in terms of sort of, you know, your measurement can be thought of as a box, and your preparation is a box. So a preparation is just a list of instructions of something you do. It has an output aperture. It can be set in motion with, say, like a button that sets it off. And all a measurement procedure is you know, some box that has an input aperture, a list of instructions of things I do, and then it generates an outcome, which I'll represent by this little pointer. And that's it. That's what preparations and measurements are. And these are the primitive concepts in which we'll describe everything. according to the operationalist. Okay, so where does that leave us in terms of interpreting quantum theory? Well, the idea is that vectors in Hilbert space describe not the physical states of systems, but rather lists of instructions of things to do in the lab. Strictly speaking, that's what they represent. So every state vector really just describes something that you could do in the lab. And similarly, every Hermitian operator just describes a measurement procedure. And that's all it represents, according to this perspective. And the role of quantum theory, according to this perspective, is just to give me experimental statistics. So here I've written down the probability of getting outcome k in this measurement, given that I implemented the list of instructions associated with preparation procedure p and the list of instructions associated with measurement procedure m. So these capital P and m should just really be interpreted as representing long recipes of what to do. So what's the probability of getting outcome k? Well, quantum theory gives us an answer. It says take the representatives of each of these guys, in particular the spectral projectors of that Hermitian operator, and plug them in to this formula, and that will tell you the probability of outcome k. And that's all. That's what quantum mechanics does for us, according to this view. And we shouldn't say anything more than this. Okay, so let's look a bit further at how to interpret the formalism. So far I've said nothing about evolution. And so what's the interpretation of unitary maps? Well, I can always insert between a preparation procedure and a measurement procedure some other set of things to do. So I'll represent that as a box that has both an input aperture and an output aperture. And we'll call that a transformation procedure. So maybe I, you know, it's what we would normally describe as, you know, passing my atom through some magnetic field. Maybe I set that up here, and maybe it changes the probabilities of outcomes. According to the operationalists, all I do is I say, right, there's a map, a unitary map, and it is associated with that list of instructions of what to do between the preparation and the measurement. And then I can incorporate that into the probability rule by just saying, well, the vector psi gets evolved by the unitary map u, and so this is the new set of probabilities for outcome k. Now, I should mention that in the operationalist perspective, I can think of that transformation as a modification of the original preparation procedure if I want. So really, this pair of boxes is just some effective preparation, because after all, it meets the description of a preparation. I start it going, and ultimately, there's an output aperture, and I can feed it into a subsequent measurement device. And so I just represent that effective, that adding on of the transformation by a change from preparation p to p prime, which is a change of the vector from psi to u psi. So that's like the Schrodinger picture. Or you can look at it in a Heisenberg picture type of way. You can think of that transformation as just a modification of the final measurement procedure. So it gives me some effective measurement procedure at the end of the day. And this time, I modify the Hermitian operator by acting u dagger on the left and u on the right, which also modifies the spectral projectors. But ultimately, that has exactly, if I look at the expectation value of these primed projectors for the original state, it's exactly the same as it was in the Schrodinger picture. So the difference between the Schrodinger and the Heisenberg picture is quite natural within this operationalist perspective. And there's one other feature that I haven't talked about, which is what happens as a result of a measurement. So sometimes it can occur that your measurement device has an output aperture, and you find that if you put subsequent measurement devices down the line, that that they have outcomes, and those outcomes are correlated with the outcomes of this first measurement. And in that case, one can think of a preparation followed by a measurement as itself another preparation for future measurements. And so you have to know how to represent that effective preparation. According to the operationalist, quantum theory gives you the following procedure. It just says, well, take whatever vector you use to represent this preparation and act upon it with the projector pk associated with the outcome that you got. So let's say you got outcome k here. Then you just use the projection postulate, and that gives you the vector for this whole effective preparation. So that's the idea. The operationalist says, we're not talking about systems and their properties. We're just talking about how to predict outcomes of experiments. Now, it turns out that if you're going to take this idea seriously, then the formalism is not general enough. I can, and I'm going to do this in the next couple of lectures, one can devise preparation procedures and measurement procedures that aren't associated with vectors and Hermitian operators. And so you have to move to a more general formalism. And so over the next couple of lectures, I'll show you how the most general preparation procedure is associated with the density operator, most general measurement with something called a positive operator valued measure, and the most general transformation with something called a trace preserving completely positive linear map. And then the generalized Born rule just asks you to take rho, act the map T upon it, multiply by the operator EK associated with the outcome of interest, and take the trace of that. And that's the more general way of doing things. And then finally, it also specifies a more general way of doing this update rule, the effective preparation here, in terms of trace decreasing completely positive linear maps. And I'll also get to this eventually. But it's not so important for now exactly how all this formalism works. The key is that you can now reformulate those postulates and eliminate the term physical state of the system entirely. So here's what they would look like. You say every preparation P is associated with a density operator rho. Every measurement M is associated with a positive operator valued measure. And the probability of M yielding outcome K given a preparation P is just this, given by this trace formula, trace EK rho. Every transformation procedure is associated with a trace preserving completely positive linear map, which takes rho to some rho prime. And finally, every measurement outcome is associated with a trace non-increasing completely positive linear map indexed by that outcome, such that you update your density operators in this way. And so no mention of physical states of systems at all, and we seem to have solved the problem. Completely operational approach to quantum theory. So that looks good. Is that enough? If it's enough, then we could stop here. So let me, again, put it to you. Is there anything that's not satisfactory about this sort of approach to quantum theory, in your opinion? Sure.
So the Born rule says that once we do a measurement, we should update our we should update our preparation to account for the result we got. But it sort of begs the question, why should we? Like, if you did this experiment and I didn't see what happened, there's no, you know, why should I update my preparation in any way? Or if I didn't see the result, you know, why can't I ignore it?
So I think an operationist will say that, you know, if one wants to be more careful with the postulates, then you know, you would say, upon, you know, learning that the outcome was K, you should describe the effect of preparation in this way. So it could be, you know, a preparation procedure which, say, does a preparation, does a measurement, records an outcome, but doesn't tell you what that outcome is. So the whole thing's contained in some black box, and you never find out the outcome. That will be represented differently from one wherein you find out the outcome and then condition upon it. So I think the operationalist can respond to that sort of challenge. Chris?
Two complaints, actually, with it. One is admittedly a bit hand-wavy, but it just feels a lot less satisfying, and it feels like it doesn't really explain anything. That it's an the operational interpretation feels like an somehow empty interpretation as presented so far. Also, I'm not sure, does it account for things like, how does it handle things like entanglement, another very non-classical phenomenon where you see there being, where you can, it suggests a real importance of the state.
I guess an operationalist would say, well, you know, entanglement is fine. It's just a particular kind of preparation procedure. And you're really, if you're a realist, you'll get into trouble perhaps trying to understand how this could, like, entangled states could be understood in terms of the properties of local systems. But as an operationalist, I don't talk about the systems at all, so I'm okay. But I take your point that it seems, you know, maybe not quite enough. Maybe, you know, you're looking for something more.
Can we see the axioms again?
Sure.
Just so that we can stay a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Any other complaints about operationalism as a philosophy? Yes.
Seems like the theory, as you've constructed it, is satisfactory. If all you want to do is what you've said you wanted to do,
that's
describe operations and measurements. But it requires the existence of people to measure or make measurements, whereas you would want physical theory to be independent of the existence of human beings.
Okay, good. Yep. Other comments? Yes.
How does the operationalist theory hold if you have, well, if you have, don't have complete knowledge about the preparation of the system, if it's part of a larger system, say, with an environment, and that could be correlated, and you're only talking about the local system, you might not have all the information.
Yeah, there's an objection that's very similar to that one that people make towards Bridgman's perspective. So Bridgman says, you know, you've only really defined a concept, so you specify everything about how, say you want to define length. He says, well, length really means a procedure for measuring length, and it makes a difference whether you jump on the train and lay down meter sticks or stand by the train and time how long it takes to go by. But if that's the case, then, you know, when do you stop providing details? You know, does it matter what's going on down the road? Does it matter what you had for breakfast that morning? You know, do I need a different concept of length for every, you know, type of cereal I might have ate this morning, because it could conceivably have an effect. So that is a good objection. The other objection I think is a really telling one, namely that if the primitive concepts are things like detectors going click, so that the operationist claims that your explanations stop when you've got detectors going click, everything reduces to detectors firing. And yet, it seems like that's something that science should be able to explain, the fact that there even exist detectors. And the fact that there exists observers who build those detectors is something that science can explain. And that explanation presumably involves some story about natural selection. And if you want to go further back and say, well, how did that get started? Then it's a story about solar evolution or stellar evolution. And further back, it's a story about cosmology. And all those kinds of stories, like if you look at textbooks on evolutionary biology, they really rely heavily on this notion of, you know, systems interacting with one another. And it's difficult to see how all those sorts of stories could be made in an entirely operational fashion. And moreover, it just seems that the operationalist refuses to explain certain things that ought to be explained. And then finally, unless there's anybody else wants to add a comment about this. No? Well, let me give you the one final objection. Oh, yes, sorry.
So unitary evolution is an extremely beautiful postulate.
Yes.
And it's very simple and very easy to understand. So it seems like you want to prove to us that you need something other than unitary evolution to explain everything in Rome again.
I'm not going to try to convince you of that. That'll be an option, and I'll get to all the options. So hold on to that thought.
So please excuse me, but if that's an option, is it the preferred one?
To hold on to unitary evolution? Well, I guess what's beautiful to one person might seem ugly to another. I think aesthetic considerations are important. But there are many different views on what's the more beautiful theory. Well, let me make the final comment before moving on. There's a very nice defense of realism in David Deutsch's book, The Fabric of Reality. I think he was basically giving a Popperian type of argument, but I think he put it really clearly. He said, if it's the case that science is just about prediction, then we ought to be completely happy with an oracle that just answers any question we have of it. So, you know, instead of a theory, you have an oracle, and you say, okay, well, if I, you know, did this experiment, what would I get this outcome? And the oracle answers yes. You know. Or would I get these outcomes with certain probabilities? And the oracle answers yes. So it saves you from doing any experiments. Now, the problem is that this oracle doesn't tell you what an interesting question is, right? So maybe you want to build a spaceship. And so you ask the oracle, well, if I build the spaceship this way, will it fly? And the oracle says, no. And now, you know, you're stuck. You know, you can't ask the oracle to tell you how to build a spaceship. That's what a theory is for. A theory is a framework for not just making predictions, but coming up with interesting questions, coming up with interesting ways of thinking about the world and new questions to ask it. So anyways, for those sorts of reasons, people often think that operationalism may be fine as a minimal interpretation of quantum theory, a place to start. We won't make mistakes by saying that quantum theory at least can be understood in this way. But one ought to have more in the interpretation. So let's talk about the possibilities for realism. OK, so back to the orthodox postulates, the ones that you'd find in the textbook, which have these references to physical states and also references to measurements. And now the strategy is we're going to eliminate all the measurement talk and leave just the realist talk. And now we have a real problem. So when I asked you guys earlier, you know, did you see problems with that? You pointed out various problems. The indeterminism and the discontinuity seemed a bit odd. But in fact, there's a real inconsistency in these postulates. So here it is. If you believe the collapse postulate, so that's the one here about the evolution of systems undergoing measurement, and if you apply that to the system, so you think of your measurement device as an external intervention, and your system is going to undergo these collapses, then you think that the evolution of your system is indeterministic and discontinuous, right? Because if you look back here, it was stated that, you know, you get outcome k with some objective probability, and there's nothing in the world that determines it. And down here, you found that the state vector, which was a complete description of the state, evolved discontinuously. So you have indeterministic and discontinuous evolution. However, if, as a physicist, you choose to model the experiment differently, you say, I'm not going to just assign a quantum state to my system. I'm going to take the whole measurement device to itself be a quantum system. After all, it's made up of atoms, so I should be able to do this. So I take the measurement device, I model it as a quantum system, and if there's other things interacting with the device, I throw those in too, and I model them all as quantum systems. Now, by the postulates, I've got a really big system. It may be impractical to model, but the postulates tell me there is some quantum state that describes all those guys. And furthermore, because the whole system I've got now is isolated, it evolves unitarily according to some unitary operator. And I know that that evolution is deterministic and continuous. So my choice of whether to model the system alone quantum mechanically and treat the device as an external intervention, or to model the pair quantum mechanically, which seems to just be a choice, a conventional choice. You know, it should just be a question of convenience for me, how I model the system. It has made a difference in terms of determinism and continuity. They make different claims about what's happening in the world, those two models. Yes?
Unitary evolution claims that an isolated system as a whole evolves continuously in unitary.
That's right.
But it doesn't say anything about a part of the system being indeterministic or discontinuous. It's not obvious to me that a part of a system evolving discontinuously and indeterministically.
Mm-hmm.
Necessarily implies that the whole system is indeterministic or discontinuous.
Well, if it were the case, so if reductionism, right? So if the state of the composite could be defined into terms of the states of the components, then you certainly couldn't have indeterminism and discontinuity in the state of in the evolution of a component, and continuity for the whole. If you don't have reductionism, then I think you would have to deny the claim that the quantum. So if you wanted to say, right, you give me the quantum state of the whole thing, but there's more to be said. You have to tell me about the state of the component. Well, then you've denied the first postulate that that composite was fully represented completely by the quantum state.
You've come to a hidden variables kind of thing.
You're moving toward the hidden variables type of approach, right? So the second problem, the second inconsistency, has to do with determinateness of properties. So my claim is that if you model the system quantum mechanically and the measurement as an external intervention, then you find that the system has certain determinate properties, whereas if you model the whole as isolated and evolving unitarily, then the system has indeterminate properties. And let me be precise about what I mean by that. This problem of determinateness is typically called the quantum measurement problem in the foundations community. So I'm going to tell you what the quantum measurement problem is. I'm here. You can think of the quantum measurement problem as sort of just a vague term for, there's some issue with measurement. But here I'm using it in a very technical sense. It's a problem with those orthodox postulates. It's an inconsistency inherent in those postulates. So we go back to the Stern-Gerlach experiment. And now we're allowed to talk about physical states of systems because we're being realists. And what we're going to do is first treat the measurement apparatus externally. We're not going to model it quantum mechanically. And we're going to imagine that we prepare the spin in a coherent superposition of z-spin up and z-spin down eigenstates. And then we measure the spin along the z-axis. And our external treatment of the measurement apparatus tells us that with probability mod a squared, we'll get z-spin up. And furthermore, if we let the system continue, if we do a non-destructive measurement on it, for example, maybe we put a little hole in the screen here, and we just detect whether the particle went through, but let it continue, then it will end up in the z-spin up state. And with probability b squared, it's z-spin down. But now what happens if we treat the measurement apparatus internally? Well, the measurement apparatus may be a very sophisticated system, huge Hilbert space. But I can trust my postulates that there is some quantum state which describes its physical state. That's what postulate one tells me. So I'm just going to write that as some initial state of the apparatus. That's the ready state. It's ready to measure. But I don't care what exactly how to write it down. The point is that such a state must exist by the first postulate. Now, what is it for this to act as a measurement device? Well, as I interact the spin with that measurement device by some unitary evolution, because we're assuming these are isolated, then it goes to a state of the following form. The spin should, at the end of the day, still be z spin up, because if I pass that through and measured it along the z axis again, I would find z spin up. So it should still be z spin up. But the apparatus should have changed its physical state to one that corresponds to indicating up. And again, by the first postulate, there's some quantum state that will do that. And we don't have to know exactly what it looks like. It's just some quantum state. Similarly, if I started with z spin down and did the unitary coupling, I would have to leave the apparatus in a quantum state corresponding to finding down. OK, so now we can ask, what happens if we put in this coherent superposition as the initial state? Well, let me remind you what the linearity of a unitary operator implies. If I have a coherent superposition of psi and phi, and I act with the unitary operator, that's just the same coherent superposition of the unitary evolute of psi and the unitary evolute of phi. And so if I feed in this a up plus b down state, I can distribute the ready state over that sum, and I evolve each of these terms independently. But I know that the unitary evolution of the first term is just z spin up tensor, some up state indicating up for the apparatus. And I know that the second term gives me z spin down and the apparatus indicates down. So at the end of the day, I have this coherent superposition. But that's a very odd situation, because this kind of coherent superposition, when it applies to the microscopic realm, we treat as having indeterminate properties, right? So in this sort of state, we would say that the z spin was neither up nor down. It was indeterminate. The rule that often gets applied here is that the properties that hold are those Hermitian operators for which the quantum state is an eigenstate. So this isn't an eigenstate of the z spin operator, so we don't say that the property of z spin holds. But similarly, this is not an eigenstate of the operator that would correspond, that would have different eigenvalues for the apparatus indicating up and the apparatus indicating down. So according to the usual way of doing things, this is a quantum state wherein the apparatus does not indicate up or indicate down. It doesn't have that property. But hang on, over here, when we treated the apparatus externally, we concluded that it would come to indicate up with probability a squared and it would come to indicate down with probability b squared. And now we seem to be finding that it doesn't have either of those properties. It's evolved, it's become entangled with the system. It's evolved deterministically and unitarily, but it doesn't have the properties that we expect it to have. So to make this sort of example dramatic, Schrodinger introduced his cat example. He said, you know, you could set things up. He didn't use a Stern-Gerlach apparatus, but let me just throw that in there. You could run a Stern-Gerlach apparatus and then make this hammer be triggered by the outcome. If you get up, the hammer stays put. If you get down, the hammer falls, breaks the flask of poison, kills the cat. And so you could have an extra term in this superposition that would have cat alive here and cat dead here, and then you'd have to conclude that the cat does not have the property of either being alive or dead, according to this way of modeling things. And so that's taken to be a very dramatic example of how microscopic indeterminateness of properties can be magnified to ridiculous situations where a cat no longer has a well-defined life status. Okay, so maybe I should pause and ask if anybody has brilliant ideas for how to solve the quantum measurement problem. Because what I want to do if for the last few minutes is tell you about different things that won't really work, and then what the options are, the things that can conceivably work. But maybe it's more fun if I ask you what you think the solution might be. And it's a bit of a trap as well, because I've got a few slides on, you know, false starts. So maybe you can provide me with some of the false starts. Okay.
You'll bite. So, so Brezina mentioned earlier that like you could give up if you wanted the completeness postulate, mm-hmm. so that the quantum state doesn't tell you everything about the system. So I'm wondering, like, is it possible in a consistent way to cut out, like, you have this unitary evolution of the entangled state. Is it possible to cut out like branches of the entangled state in a way that like that gives you the same gives you the same probabilities for observable results? Like if you go through this whole thing and you come out the end and you open the box and the cat is dead, mm-hmm. you can then say, well, you know, obviously now we're in state this, but unitary evolution says we should be in state with all these branches here. Mm-hmm. Can we then go back sort of retroactively and like slash out parts of the? I mean, you would so presumably
deny unitary evolution.
Okay, with that.
Yeah.
Okay.
All so right. That's definitely one of the options, and that's not one of the false starts. That's one of the viable options: is to deny unitary evolution, the option that we were told is very inelegant, but people nonetheless consider it. So that's certainly one of the options. Yes. You could, yeah. That's denying unitarity, because unitary evolution is linear. So denying unitarity, you might want to deny both. You might want to deny the continuity, but keep it linear. Or you might want to say, well, it's going to be discontinuous and it's going to be nonlinear. You could go that far as well.
I'll bite on that as well, and that Niemann presented when he was here, which is that we should just be okay with the idea that we become entangled with the systems we measure, and that the internal view is somehow the correct view, and that the external view is a byproduct of applying a viewpoint where we can separate the two, which is that we really can't, and so we get strange results when we try to do that.
So are you saying that there's two descriptions? It sounded a bit like you're moving towards Everett, and then you said the external view is just not right, meaning that we shouldn't take seriously the idea that the composite system involves unitarity.
No, the viewpoint where the measurement and device is external and you have a collapse is somehow an artifact of the fact that we are entangled with the system we're trying to measure.
So I'm not quite following. So you're saying it doesn't. Oh, so it doesn't actually collapse, as you're saying that this.
Right. It just looks like it.
Right. Okay.
Firmly following one branch.
So this, this does sound like Everett's solution to the problem. So that's another option, the many worlds option. So that's a viable one. So nobody wants to bite on any of the false starts. Nobody wants to say, I'm going to defend the orthodox approach. Well, okay, let's go through the possibilities. So these, it's useful to hear about these false starts because it's easy to get yourself into these traps, you know, these ways of thinking. And many people have done so. So it's worth going over them. So one thing that people often say is, oh, look, that final superposition state, you should really interpret it as disjunction, meaning, you know, this or that. So what this means is either the Z-spin is up and the apparatus indicates up, or the Z-spin is down and the apparatus indicates down, with probabilities blah and blah, respectively. What's wrong with that?
Changing what you mean by adding two quantum states to you're changing the meaning of this plus symbol halfway through your...
Yeah, but they might say, well, I realize that this is how I have to interpret it.
Isn't there a possibility that the spin is up and the apparatus measures down, and you've just assumed that's zero by doing this?
You might in any practical situation have such a term. But I don't think that's... I could incorporate that, and I would still get the quantum measurement problem, that I will have, you know, no determinate properties, not even an apparatus indicating down and the Z spin being up. That just, you know, wouldn't come out. So my question really here is there any of the postulates that have been denied in this sort of solution?
One problem that I can say is that I don't see if it can compensate for the fact that the Bezier inequalities are violated.
It certainly, you might have concerns that you would have non-local actions in this sort of approach. But that's not necessarily a problem. I mean, Bell's theorem, as we'll come to eventually, seems to suggest that every realist is going to have a problem with locality. If you are going to steer away from operationalism, then you're going to have some locality issues.
As far as I can see, you just delayed your problem by one level of abstraction. Earlier, in the external approach, you had A up plus B down, and when you measured that, you got up with A squared and down with B squared. I have another state, A into another state, plus B into another state, and now you're saying that you get the first state with A squared and the second state with B squared, which is just the same thing, you're just delaying it by one step. I mean, you would get the exact same result this if you measured this system by another external apparatus.
That is true. So this is sometimes called, you know, von Neumann's argument. Von Neumann pointed out that I can always move my cut between internal and external further out. So I can say, right, I'll keep my first measurement apparatus as internal, but I'm going to hit it with another measurement apparatus, like when a camera looks at it and records what the outcome is. So I think of that as an external intervention which enforces a collapse on the pair. Now, the quantum measurement problem, the response people would make to that is, well, but anywhere you put the cut, I can always put it further. I can always keep going till I've got a full isolated system. If I want, I can put you into the system. I can make you part of the quantum system, and then you will become entangled with everything else. And your, you know, brain won't have any determinate properties, such as observing the spin to have been found up or observing the spin to have been found down. So you still have a quantum measurement problem,
exactly,
despite where you're moving the cut. So the problem here, I'll tell you where this goes wrong. So the idea was that, you know, this might allow you to save the orthodox postulates, but in fact, all this does is deny the representational completeness of psi, because it says, oh, this quantum state means that either this is the case or that is the case. And the point is that that would mean that, you know, this thing is consistent with two possible physical states. And therefore, the quantum state would not be a complete description of reality, because I would have to further specify whether, you know, in addition to this being the quantum state, is the physical state this one or this one? So this solution is actually a kind of a hidden variable approach. It says, yes, you know, maybe we can interpret this as this or that, or I should say, maybe we can think of situations where I assign this quantum state as really being described by apparatuses indicating up or apparatuses indicating down. But to do so, I need to provide something more than the quantum state to represent the physical state of the system. Yes?
I don't know, maybe I'm just misunderstanding this, but is this even linear? Because if you were to then go and feed each of your, coherent superposition with a phase flipped one,
yep.
So that the phis cancel out, then you would wind up with trying to add your amplitudes in a naive way.
That's another good response to this, which is to say, if this really means just that or that, then why is it that I can distinguish in a measurement this state from this state, or from an incoherent mixture of this and this? So when we get to density operators, there's a way of writing when you simply don't know whether something's this or this. It's a sum of the outer products of this term with this term. But experiments can distinguish those guys. And in particular, the relative phase here can be revealed in an experiment, or you can get different experimental statistics depending on that relative phase. So this sort of interpretation would seem to deny that there's any importance to that relative phase, and that just seems wrong. Okay, so another very similar approach is to say, well, what you ought to do is ignore the spin and just look at the what's called the reduced density operator for the apparatus. So we'll come to reduced density operator shortly, but the idea is it's one of these incoherent sums, so it's the outer product of this state and the outer product of this state with itself, and these weights. And the argument is that, now I can really interpret this guy, the component, as being one or the other, even though the composite is in this one state. But again, the response to this is that either if you say that the component is really in the up state, the apparatus is really in the up state, then either you're denying that it was really in this entangled state, and you're just saying, no, it was in this product state here. So either you're just denying your original claim, or you're saying there's something more to be said about this pair of systems than just this entangled state. There's something to be specified that really this apparatus is in the up state, in which case you're denying the representational completeness of the quantum state. So you're not saving the orthodox postulates. Yes?
That's something you said.
Yes.
So you said it's certainly true. For some circumstances, you could do something to this state that allows you to be sensitive to the relative phase between anything.
Yep.
So in all of these false starts,
yes.
That information is lost.
That's right.
So if the false starts are correct, then they can only be true for a sufficiently large or complex system.
When you say if the false starts are correct, what do you mean by that?
So what do you want to say about the relative phase between A and B? If it's measurable, we have to attribute reality to it, so we can't go in a direction where that information is lost.
Well, I guess I would say that if you want to follow the collapse route, right? So if you want to deny that unitary evolution is fundamental, which is a viable response, then you could say, actually, your expectations about what would occur when you look for that relative phase are wrong. That actually, if you go and look for that relative phase, you find it's not there. That, for sufficiently large systems, I get collapses. Here, I'm just sort of criticizing the point of view that the orthodox position is consistent and can be made sense of. So I'm just saying that, clearly, if you just wanted to interpret that coherent superposition as an either-or, then you have a problem, because experiments do reveal that relative phase.
So there are two different approaches here. The one you're taking is the purely philosophical one, or the postulate self-consistent.
Yeah, that's
there's,
right.
There's another one, which is you could actually try and take a measurement and falsify this.
Yeah, that's right. So given that I'm out of time, I'll spare you the other false starts. They involve appeal to the environment. If you throw an environment in, you just treat it internally and you have the same problem. It's just like Schrodinger's cat. He just gets mixed into the whole indeterminateness. And then there's another one, which I'm not going to go over. And here's the bottom line. So this is sort of a bit of a setup for what's going to happen later in the course. What are our options? Well, one thing, as we heard, is to deny the universality of the quantum dynamics. So there was a claim that unitary evolution applies to everything. Maybe that's not true. Maybe when things get sufficiently large or sufficiently complex or have some other feature, unitary evolution is not the correct dynamics, and some other dynamics applies. So I would say there are two interpretational strategies that fall under this category. There are models which sort of assume that there is some sort of cut, and on one side of the cut there's quantum dynamics, and on the other side of the cut is classical dynamics. And those are very vague models. I won't say very much about them. The model that's much more specific in this context are called collapse models, dynamical collapse models. And they're ones that say there's a single kind of evolution. It applies to all systems. But it just so happens that, to good approximation, microscopic systems evolve unitarily, and to good approximation, macroscopic systems evolve by collapses. So we'll see something about those. Option two, deny the representational completeness of psi. We heard that a couple of times. So you just say, no, there's more to be said about the physical state of the system than its quantum state. And I'm going to contrast two approaches to that. One will be called the psi-ontic hidden variable models. De Broglie-Bohm theory will be an example of that. And another are the psi-epistemic hidden variable models. The difference here is on whether you think of psi as describing physical reality and just being supplemented with something else, some other variables that describe reality, or whether you think of psi as merely describing your knowledge of reality. And so all the physical variables are basically forming a space, and psi is like a probability distribution over that space. And then the third outcome, which we also heard about, was to deny that there is a unique outcome. You know, maybe both that the external view is correct. There's just deterministic, unitary, continuous evolution. All things happen. There's a branch of the wave function where all things happen. But subjectively, us living inside the universe, we just see one of those things. And so really, this inconsistency is not an inconsistency, because all we say is that subjectively collapses occur, objectively collapses don't occur. Something that I'm not sure really deserves to be under the realist category is to deny some aspect of classical logic or classical probability theory. And there you get approaches like quantum logic and quantum Bayesianism. I might have a little bit to say about those. And then finally, you know, this is research project. Maybe there's some other aspect currently unspecified or not sufficiently well articulated of this framework we're working in which has to be denied, and there are other interesting avenues out of this. So with that, I'll stop. Sorry for going over time.
Doesn't really didn't get that enough. I'll make more.